The third case for oral argument this morning is Sally Nist, appellant versus Theodore Nist, appellee. For the appellant, Linda Lee Viken and Aaron Cameron, attorneys from Rapid City. Ms. Viken, I understand you'll be making the presentation. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And for the appellee, Theodore Nist, is Terry Gunderson and Terry Williams, excuse me, and attorney also from Rapid City. Correct? All right. Should note for the record that Justice Zinner is participating in this case. However, he is attending Brent Wilbur's funeral this morning in Pierre. It's a pallbearer. He will be conferencing with us when we conference, and we'll be having access to this oral argument because we archived these. So with that, Ms. Viken, you may proceed, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Chief Justice Gilbertson, members of the court, counsel. May it please the court. What brings us here today really are three issues. First of all, whether a modification of a property settlement, a property division made by a court, can be modified some 9 years later in such a manner as to deprive a person of rights which had accrued under the former decision. Secondly, if so, was it an abuse of discretion for the trial judge not to consider our request to reinstate alimony? And thirdly, under either condition, was it an abuse of discretion for the court to deny our request for attorney's fees? I think some salient facts are necessary for the court to look at in deciding this case. We can start back in 1980 when the Foreign Service Act was passed, and we appended that to our brief. It's a key factor in this case. In that law, a federal law, Congress recognized that spouses of individuals serving in the Foreign Service do not have an opportunity to create a career of their own. They move often, sometimes can't get work, don't have a retirement. Congress felt so very strongly about this that they said that that individual, that spouse, is entitled to a pro rata share of the retirement. What we call a coverture fraction, same thing as we use in military, a percentage based upon how long they were married to them. But the court also, or the Congress, excuse me, also went further than that. They said there must be a specific waiver or a specific deprivation of that right. Otherwise, it was retained by the spouse. And that's the issue that came up in this case. These parties were married in 1983. My client, Sally, is 9 years older than Ted. That's significant because of the effect that it has on Sally in making this decision. Ted filed for divorce in September of 1994. After protracted discovery, there was a trial set in September of 1995. Judge Grosshands sat on that trial. It was a simple one-day trial. Prior to that trial, we submitted a brief to Judge Grosshands, and in that brief, we pointed out the federal law and my client's right to two things under that federal law, a share of the pension and an annuity, what we would call sometimes a survivor's benefit annuity.
Now, I understand there were no findings of fact in that proceeding, correct?
That's right, Your Honor.
Does that affect the appeal that's before us now?
I think it probably depends upon what the court, this court determines was the basis for Judge Trimble's decision. The fact that there were no findings makes it, in my estimation, more of a guesstimate for Judge Trimble as to what Judge Grosshands would have done under the circumstances. Judge Grosshands did decide this case from the bench with the exception of attorney's fees. He took that under advisement, and on November 30th, he issued a decision on attorney's fees. I prepared a judgment, and it was sent over for Mr. Sweetland, who was the attorney at the time, to review. And it was eventually signed by Judge Grosshands on January 19th, 2006. Subsequent to that, in February of 1996, about 1 month later, I received a letter, which is in the record, from Mr. Sweetland, saying that he thought the judgment needed to be amended to be more specific on the waiver, and or that my client needed to sign a waiver. And would I agree to that? We did not agree to that. After that, as is shown in the record, Mr. Nist then contacted his former wife and asked her to sign a waiver. She refused to sign a waiver. As the record indicates, she had already given the decree to the Department of State, and they had told her that she was entitled to a share of the retirement. Those events occurred, by the way, within the appeal time. Then in April of 1996, a waiver was sent to me to have my client sign. Again, we refused to do that. Now, how Mr. Nist can now say he didn't have knowledge that he needed to have a waiver or he needed to have the language read a certain way is beyond my imagination, because these documents clearly say he knew there was a problem. But he did nothing until 9.5 years later, when he decided to retire, and he made what was entitled a motion to modify property division. Well, on its face, that's an improper motion unless you can cite very specific, limited reasons. This court has said many times that a property settlement is final, not subject to modification. In the brief in support of this motion, there was a request for clarification of a judgment or for a 60B6 opening of the judgment. We filed a motion to dismiss, motion for judgment on the pleadings. We filed affirmative defenses, and we asked in the event that the court would open it and make any changes to give us alimony and attorney's fees. Those were all summarily denied by the court. Judge Trimble did not have a specific hearing. He had an argument on the motion, and then I raised the point as to whether we needed to file findings at this point, and his position was that under the statute relating to findings, which says you don't have to make my motions. I happen to think that if that is a correct interpretation, we should amend that statute, because this is obviously a substantive change that has an effect on my client.
I have a question on, I think you had, under tab B in your exhibit, or in your appendix that you've, I believe this is your brief, yes. There's a court's distribution. Can you indicate, was this attached to, where did this come from, I guess? When you look at the file, there's several of them, and then some of them are more, some of the distributions spreadsheets that I looked at had plaintiffs proposed, defendants proposed, court's decision. Is this just the court's part of it? Is that what this is?
This B is the amended one that Judge Trimble did,
okay,
and that Ms. Williams prepared, and that's her document that's attached to that.
Okay, so we don't have attached to this the whole spreadsheet that was presented to Judge Grossan's in our attached to the briefs, do we?
You may not have, Your Honor.
This is not dissimilar, is it?
No, it's fairly similar. Yes, Your Honor, it is.
So if in that case, then in line 12, is that the retirement we're looking at? The FSPS cash value of retirement as of July, and I can't read 19 something, $93,498.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and then her is the CSRS, the cash value of her retirement, then the 54.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now one shows up in her column, one shows up in his column.
Correct.
So under your analysis, then what? If this is the part that came from Judge Grossan's spreadsheet distribution of the court that somebody prepared at that time, how does that square with your analysis that she still gets her portion of the $93,498? Because shouldn't that have shown up in her category and line here then?
The record does not tell us what cash value means. For example, if we take the South Dakota retirement system and we look at that retirement system and you look at your statement, there's a place on it that tells you what the current cash value is based upon the contributions that have been made to date.
But somebody must have presented evidence that this came from. Or did the parties not disagree on it?
On it being the cash value?
Mm-hmm.
No, there was no disagreement that it was the cash value. However, there was nothing before Judge Trimble that told him what the cash value meant. It would have been extra record, or if the transcript of the original trial had been transcribed, we might know the answer to it. Honestly, It was 9.5 years ago. I was amazed I still had my file, let alone to tell you what cash value meant. But if it meant cash, if the cash value meant the value that, of contributions at that time, that does not preclude the court being able to still give her a benefit later, because that benefit changes over time. It gets smaller, of course, as time goes on, because he continued in the service and she continued to work.
But it certainly would throw off the bottom the values here as they were divided, wouldn't it?
It would throw off, it wouldn't throw off the values if that was the cash value at
the
time.
Well, it put more in her category and less in his.
It could, depending on how long he stayed in the service.
Well, when you read the record, it looks to me like what Judge Trimble was just trying to do was to correct correct a prior judgment that Judge Grosshans entered.
Well, the problem with that, Your Honor, is that this court has made it pretty clear in Wolf versus Weber that if you're going to use the clerical mistake, it has to not be a substantive change. And no one can say this isn't a substantive change, because the record is clear that the Department of State ruled that my client was entitled to a portion of it, and after this change, they ruled she was not. That's clearly a substantive change to a woman who's 64 years old and who counted on it.
Are we controlled by what the Department of State says about a South Dakota judgment, though?
Pardon me?
I say, are we controlled by what the Department of State says about a South Dakota judgment?
No, we are not, Your Honor, but it clearly is a substantive change in her, in what she received under the judgment. I think the court can recognize that, because that's the issue. That's the issue that brought him back to court, was the fact that it wasn't clear enough for him. It wasn't clear enough for the State Department, who had already ruled she was entitled to a portion of it. And so I don't believe that's a clerical error. I think it's a substantive change. It's, this court has said that the ability to correct is not a substitute for appeal or to affect substantive portions of a judgment or decree. If it is a deliberate choice and requires the application of the law to the facts, it's judicial. If Judge Grosshans had made that decision, it would take an application of the law to the facts for him to say, I'm not going to give you any of that future retirement.
Well, if this were unclear, which appears that you're arguing you're arguing it's clear, but you know, when you look at it, there are some things missing. On if he did intend to, or did know that she was going to get part of it, it should be over here. Let's say it's unclear. Is there the ability under the law then for Judge Trimble to reopen it for clarity and take evidence? And then what kinds of findings would he need to be? What would he need to do in order to do that?
I don't believe he can, Your Honor. I think this matter is res judicata. I think our defenses of laches and waiver clearly apply. In this case, there is no question that there was a concern on the part of Ted as to the form of the judgment and how it was written. And by the way, he has a JD, as the record reflects, and another advanced degree. And he had a good attorney. And they knew there was a problem. At least they said there was a problem. But they didn't do anything about it. And the doctrine of laches and waiver has to apply here.
But I mean, that wasn't determined. So would we have to send it back for that purpose, for Trimble to look at that issue of laches?
We raised that issue, Your Honor. That was one of our defenses.
And he did not make any findings on it.
No, because he didn't feel findings were necessary. You're right.
So is that a remedy that we can, do we send it back then for him to make those findings?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor. It seems to me that it's pretty clear on its face by the record that he knew about it and that he didn't take action for 9.5 years. My client knew about it too, and my client was counting on it. She was counting on that share of her retirement, and he waited for that period of time. There's nothing in the record that gives an excuse, in my estimation, except he says, well, I got a ruling from the Department of State now, and I know it isn't valid. It's very clear my client had gotten that ruling long ago, and he was concerned about it. If he was concerned about it, he should have done something. This is, to me, it's a classic case of laches and waiver. He knew his rights, and he sat on them to the detriment of my client. He now comes in when she's old enough to retire and says, oh, I'm sorry, you're not going to get what you thought you were going to get.
Now, those are equitable remedies, latches and waiver.
Yes.
So is there a, would there have been an argument on the other side that, perhaps your client doesn't come in with clean hands since she refused to sign the waiver that he signed? There were mutual waivers, and he signed his, and she didn't sign hers.
He didn't have to sign a waiver. CSRS doesn't require a waiver.
He did, however, didn't he?
Sure he did. But the fact of the matter is, Judge Grossans was sitting on the bench. If he had a problem with it, he should have taken care of it at that point in time. I mean, to now say it's my client's fault, my client, in our pretrial brief, we submitted the statute. At trial, we submitted the statute. I don't think it's my obligation then to propose a finding or a decision by the judge that's adverse to my client when I have taken the necessary steps to tell the judge what needs to be done and he doesn't do it. That burden rested on Ted and his attorney. And if they fail to do it, which they clearly did, why does my client 9 years later then have to bear the consequences of it? If the judge had ruled specifically to deprive her at that point in time, or if that issue had been raised by them that they wanted him to do that, we could have argued that to the court. We don't know what Judge Grossans would have done at that point in time. And we, of course, would have had a right to appeal to this court had the judge done something along those lines at that point that we disagreed with. But we were deprived of that. Our only appeal is this.
Is it local practice in Rapid City not to have findings of fact in contested divorces? I've never seen this before.
Oh, it's fairly common, Your Honor.
Okay, because yeah. Where I come from in the state, there are always findings of fact in contested cases.
No, if the parties accept what the court has ruled, then it's very common that we would waive findings.
Because if we had findings by Judge Grossans, we wouldn't try to have to pick his brain 9 years after the fact.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
Okay.
You know, we also argued, besides waiver, which is, of course, possession of a right, full knowledge of facts, and does or forbears doing something inconsistent with the exercise of that right, which falls right in line with the things we've talked about here. He waited for 9.5 years to do something about it. You know, we also believe that, in essence, it was res judicata. That issue of what was required by the law was put into evidence by us. It then became incumbent upon Ted and his attorney, if they wanted to do something about that, they wanted to make sure of the waiver, to do it. You know, the judge in his decision, Judge Grossans, that is, says the cash value is what he is awarding. But we don't know what the cash value was as we sit here today, nor did Judge Trimble. Judge Trimble just said he felt that that's what the judge meant, and so that's what he did. But the problem with that is, of course, we didn't have the transcript of the last trial. No evidence or no testimony was given. We asked for a continuance, and it was not granted. He basically looked at the affidavits and said, based on that he was going to do it. Well, my client at that point is then deprived of her remedy. What is she supposed to do? Now we've decided that Judge Grossans meant to do something 9.5 years ago. We can't argue to Judge Grossans. We have no way of impacting that decision. First of all, we don't know whether Judge Grossans would have made that decision, but even if we assume that for the purposes of this argument, we would have then had an opportunity to argue to Judge Grossans about what we would ask for then if she was going to lose that. The record is clear. My client asked for about twice as much alimony for twice as long. But she accepted the lower amount of alimony, and she recognized she'd have something eventually, not very much.
But we really don't know that. I mean, we really don't. Trimble didn't know that as well. But why that particular agreement went into play. But let me ask you this. If this is unclear, which obviously that's part of the argument, is there a process for then, or some kind of a procedure, assuming you can get past the latches deal, is there a procedure to open it? And you're saying there isn't, even if it's unclear.
Oh, I think there's a procedure, Your Honor. It's just you don't wait 9.5 years to do it. You know, 60B6 says within a reasonable time. And this court has held in a case where the law changed on military benefits and a woman came in, I believe it was 3 years later, this court said that was too late. She sat on her rights.
And we don't know if Judge Trimble relied upon 60B. Or
no, we do not know what Judge Trimble relied on. His decision was not incorporated in the judgment, so it's not appropriate for me to refer to that. But the judgment itself says it's a motion to modify,
right.
And that's the basis for it. So, you know, the issue just here is essential fairness in my mind. We are now deprived of our opportunity to have the very judge who decided something that we believe was favorable to my client make the decision as to whether he meant to do something more than what he did. And we are then placed in front of a judge who didn't hear the case, didn't hear the facts, doesn't know the parties, and who is only going to confirm what he believes that the judge said and meant. And at that point, he is not making, I don't believe, he certainly didn't address it that way, an independent judgment. He is merely saying what he believes that the judge meant, which means I can't argue to him that we shouldn't have done that or that shouldn't have happened because he wasn't the decision maker. So I think under all the circumstances, this is a case that cries out for reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Baker. Ms. Williams, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. This case is clear that Judge Trimble did not abuse his discretion in deciding that it was appropriate to amend Judge Grosshand's decision to conform to the intent of Judge Grosshand's. Ms. Viken indicated that the order does not specify which statute Judge Trimble utilized to actually amend the judgment. However, in filings, it was presented to both counsel and to Judge Trimble. The basis was either 15660A or 15660B, subsection 6.
If he would have decided it under 60B, wouldn't he have had to make findings of fact, conclusions of law?
I'm sorry, would he have?
If he would have decided under 60B, wouldn't the judge then have had to make findings of fact, conclusions of law? Because you have to fit within one of the categories, and the category you cite is which one? What is the requirement?
That's the catch-all.
Okay, the catch-all. Then wouldn't he have had to listen to the testimony and make findings that this, under the circumstances and under these findings, it fits within that category? And he did not.
Your Honor, I do not know whether he would have to do findings of fact and conclusions of law or not. The abuse of discretion would apply, and so with that, I would think that something would need to be done. But the judge indicated, based upon motions, that findings of fact and conclusions of law were not needed. And I believe in particular he was, because of that, I think he was looking particularly at 60A. Ms. Viken indicates that it's evident that this is a judicial change. If I can, let's go back over that for just a moment. Ms. Viken advised the court, Judge Grosshand's, of a statute that required that the court acknowledge Ms. Niss' entitlement to husband's Foreign Service pension, and then to clearly divest wife of that intention. Testimony was taken, evidence was given as to that statute. Judge Grosshand's recognized that statute when he made his decision. He didn't come right out and say, okay, I'm recognizing this statute and I'm clearly divesting wife of that entitlement. However, in his record, he acknowledged the Foreign Service pension system. He indicated specifically, husband was to keep his retirement, wife was to keep her retirement. He gave a number of factors as to why he was making that decision. First, he said that he recognized wife's contribution to the husband's Foreign Service was a detriment to her own career, and recognized that somehow he needed to compensate her for that. He recognized that she had 3 years of credible service with the civil service retirement system and that she could actually buy back 12 years. He indicated that he was going to be awarding alimony to Ms. Nist, not only just for the purpose of her need financially, but also as a means of either restitution or rehabilitative alimony because of what she provided to husband in pursuing his career. He also indicated that Mr. Nist was to ensure that the wife maintained his health insurance until she could come up with her own. And then what's important is he said to ensure that alimony, husband either had to have a life insurance of depreciating value for the payment of that alimony or name wife as former spouse on his Foreign Service pension system. That goes directly to court saying, you're not going to receive this wife, but I am going to allow you to perhaps have an annuity to ensure that you have some protection for the alimony.
What about this argument of the finality of some of these things and sitting? I mean, everybody knew what you're just talking about at the time, and yet your client just ignores it for 9 years and now wants another judge to go in and try to read the mind of a previous judge. I mean, isn't there some problem with that?
Your Honor, obviously, with all due respect, I cannot indicate what the intentions of anybody would have been. I wasn't one of the members.
Mm-hmm.
However, that being said, the statute requires that the court recognize the entitlement and then divest. It says clearly divest. What is more clear in divesting, as you pointed out, on the distribution sheet that was prepared originally by Ms. Viken? The court adopted the distribution sheet of Ms. Nist and went through that and said item by item of what it was doing. That is within the transcript of the decision of Judge Groshans. Now, to answer that next question, the actual question of why wait, based upon what was provided, I think it's fair to say that with what was provided, there was a clear divestment of wife's entitlement. The court also indicated parties prepare any documents necessary to ensure compliance with my decision. Therefore, waivers were sent. Ms. Nist did not sign her waiver. And again, I can't state what the rationale was, but it makes sense to me that in looking at the distribution sheet, in looking at the judgment, one could look at that and say, okay, wife has been divested. We don't need to pursue this any further. It's fine.
But to be clear, on that distribution sheet where it refers to a cash value of $94,000 in the husband, shouldn't it say which includes the wife's federal statutory rights to an annuity under the Foreign Service Act? Shouldn't that cash value include her rights under the Foreign Service Act?
I don't know that it should have, because again, what's more clear than saying the cash value of the Foreign Service pension is going to husband? Wife is being divested of that.
What doesn't say divested, and apparently there's a statute that says that there's got to be, that the spouse is entitled to a fraction unless there's a specific waiver or surrender. So where is your specific waiver or surrender?
It doesn't have to be a specific waiver. It has to be expressed. There has to be an expression of the
specific and express. What's the difference?
To me, expression is it expressed? Is there indication based upon the distribution sheet, based upon the judgment, that wife is not receiving that retirement? And it's there.
Well,
it's expressed within that distribution sheet.
But if it gives the cash value of what the husband is getting, but that makes no reference to the fact that it includes the rights that the wife formerly had, or the fact that the rights that she has under a federal statute, how is it either express, specific, or divesting of it?
Again, all I can do is say that based upon a review of the distribution sheet, in my view, that is express. Of when the husband is, when in the column says foreign service pension, full value is husband's. There isn't a portion over in wife's column, there isn't anything about wife, you're going to keep future entitlement. There's nothing there to indicate anything that the court is going to continue wife's entitlement to that foreign service pension system.
Did Judge Grossens address that in his oral findings when he was going through these?
Did he address
that particular line item in the distribution?
He did.
What did he say?
All Judge Grossens did was indicate that he was going to adopt the distribution sheet, Exhibit B, as proposed by Ms. Viken. Apologize here, let me get to it. And he just went through it line item by line item of the distribution. It's starting with page 10 of his decision, and then continue on to page 11, in particular, line item 7 on page 11, item 12, FSPS, cash value of retirement, 93,498 is his. Goes on to say item 17. At that time, there was an error of FSPS, cash value retirement for wife's civil service retirement system. A 54,758 is hers, and continues on.
You know, I know that lawyers in domestic relations practice learn to use certain magic language in order to make sure that certain things are done, with Railroad Retirement Act and other various federal acts governing pensions. Lawyers have little provisions they put in there, like I say, magic language, boilerplate language that's clear. And what concerns me here is that there isn't this language in this judgment. And apparently, Mr. Niss knew that he needed more, and then waited for 9 years or 9.5 years to get this cleared up. Why is that not laches?
Again, I do not believe it's apparent that Mr. Nist knew that he had to do something else. I do not believe laches applies in particular.
But isn't it true? Let me just stop you there then.
Excuse me?
Let me just stop you just for a minute on what he knew. Isn't it true, though, that his attorney a couple of times asked opposing counsel to sign a waiver? That issue came up several times, and opposing counsel said her client would not be signing a waiver. So how can you say he didn't know there was a problem?
Again, because there wasn't anything indicated by the State Department that there was a problem until 9.5 years later.
All right.
Again, is that Mr. Sweetland reviewed the judgment, reviewed the distribution sheet, wanted to comply with court order of parties, fill out whatever documents are necessary to ensure that there's compliance with this. But when wife did not sign that, did not pursue it further because the distribution sheet said, husband, foreign service pension is yours. As far as laches requires that the party to be barred had full knowledge of the facts upon which the action was based, regardless of that knowledge, engaged in an unreasonable delay before commencing suit, and that allowing the action would prejudice the other party.
So what's missing then here that laches does not apply?
Full knowledge. Mr. Nist was not aware that there was a problem until 9.5 years later. He did not engage in unreasonable delay. When he learned of the problem, he presented it to the court of a need to clarify the judgment to conform to the court's intent. And then prejudice is missing. The court gave wife her property, gave husband his property. There is nothing that is changing the original decree of the court. And with that, I guess I'd like to say that I think that this case clearly falls within 15660A. Ms. Viken indicated one case of Wolf versus Weber. In Wolf versus Weber, this court said that it's the central purpose of Rule 60A is to effectuate the contemporaneous intent of the court and to ensure the judgment reflects that intent. That was further clarified in Reeser versus Reeser. In Reeser versus Reeser, the court starts off with that a clerical error is everything else but a judicial change or an exercise of judicial function. Specifically, the court indicated, in other words, the distinction does not depend so much upon the person making the error as to whether it was the deliberate result of judicial reasoning and determination, regardless of whether it was made by the clerk, counsel, or judge. The court went on to recognize that Federal Rule Civil Procedure 60A has also been interpreted by the federal courts in finding that a clerical error is a type of mistake or omission, mechanical in nature, which is apparent on the record and which does not involve a legal decision or judgment by an attorney. Clerical errors include the implementation of what was intended and what the court had accepted as the proper resolution. They also include failure to memorialize part of a decision. Again, going to the transcript of Judge Grosshand's decision, it's evident that he was giving husband the entirety of the Foreign Service pension system and was divesting wife of that. And by reviewing that transcript, Judge Trimble said, yes, I find this to be appropriate to go ahead and amend to include the magic language that the State Department required to allow the divestment to occur. Ms. Viken said that Congress enacted that statute because it felt strongly about what a spouse gave up. However, all the cases cited and where she indicates that there's that strong desire of the court to recognize this divestment of having a clear indication of the right and then to divest, all of the cases are dealing with a stipulation. There has not been one single case cited by either party, nor do I know of one that exists, that says court has done something wrong. Court needs to be more clear in its decision. And again, Congress recognized that was one of the need to recognize in a stipulation, wife might not have an attorney overseas, and that wife may need to have some protection, so that stipulation indicated the recognition of that entitlement and then divest. As far as the other equitable defenses, I don't know that they're appropriate. This court has not made this decision, but in looking at cases that this court has cited, in particular, I believe, again, Wolf versus Weber, where it was citing Spoomer versus Spoomer. In Spoomer versus Spoomer, it was recognized that equitable defenses of detrimental reliance or estoppel do not apply to a court's order based upon a valid statute. Again, if we're looking at 15660A, the court has the authority, the inherent authority, to correct a judgment.
2 minutes.
And in doing so, the court is not precluded, or I shouldn't say precluded, the equitable defenses don't apply when it's the court's decision, when it's the court's action. The court had the inherent authority to do this and did so. Again, in Spoomer, which was cited in Wolf, it was recognized that 60 days to correct or clarify decrees and judgments as to express the intent of the court. And it recognized that the court, that recognized conduct occurred after the original order, if at all. And what I mean there is that if this court finds that Mr. Nist was somehow doing something improper, that occurred after the original order that divested wife of her entitlement. The other equitable defenses of res judicata doesn't apply. This is not a request of having a collateral attack on the court's decision. It is asking for a clarification of that original decision. Waiver does not apply. Mr. Nist did not have anything to indicate that he was forbearing any interest that he had. He didn't do anything inconsistent with that entitlement of having his foreign service. When he found out there was a problem, he reacted. Finally, as to the argument of alimony and attorney fees. Again, those are questions of abuse of discretion. Ms. Nist asked for alimony in the event the court divested her of her, of her perceived entitlement to the Foreign Service pension. There was no change.
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Viking, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to address several things that Ms. Williams has raised. Let's take first the issue of the court's decision on alimony, that is Judge Grosshand's decision on alimony, and his statement about keeping her on the survivor's benefit. As this court is well aware, there's a difference between an alimony right and a property right. She had a property right under the federal law, which was a share of his retirement. What Judge Grosshands did was say that I'm also giving an alimony right, and I want that alimony right protected. That is not inconsistent with her maintaining her federal right to a share of his pension. It is in addition to that, just as sometimes we will have insurance policies ordered to carry out the terms of an order for alimony. So I don't see that as an inconsistent decision. What I do see as inconsistent is Mr. Nist asking repeatedly for waivers, and then when they were not forthcoming, not doing anything about them. And Justice Sabers, you're correct. The federal statute and the cases are very clear about explicit waivers. On page 27 of my initial brief and also in my subsequent brief, I addressed that. And while Ms. Williams is accurate that the cases so far have dealt with a written agreement of the parties, if you look at those cases, I mean, even when they had just about everything but the kitchen sink in them, because they did not have an express waiver, the court held they were not binding. And in fact, there's a case where the court tried to basically change the federal law after the fact to apply in a certain case, and they said you can't do that. The federal law takes precedence. It's a rare case where the federal government steps into family law in as explicit a manner as they have in this case. And that was what was necessary, and that is not what happened in this case.
Address your opponent's argument that the property distribution formula itself is an express declaration.
Your Honor, I think in light of the cases, I just can't see how that would be. In the cases, the case said that general waivers are not good enough. It has to be expressly provided language. It will be strictly construed. It must actually address the annuity. That's what the cases say. It must say those magic words. Anything short of that is not sufficient under the case law and under the federal statute. And that federal statute does.
What are the years of those cases? Would it have been after this original decision by Judge Grosshands?
Let's see, Your Honor. Yes. Some of them are, yes.
So if that's the case, couldn't you use that as an argument for going in and clarifying it now that the law has made its requirement so explicit?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Nist clearly understood that he needed something more. He understood that within a month after the judgment because he wrote a letter saying it wasn't clear enough and it had to be more clear. So I think he had the knowledge. He also was, of course, the employee of the Federal Service Administration and certainly Foreign Service, and he certainly could have sought an opinion from the Department of State on that, just as my client did. So I don't think that that would be a sufficient basis. There is a case, by the way, I see in looking at this. There's a case, apparently, that was decided in 1980 that is cited in one of the later cases. So it looks to me like there may be some earlier ones, but I wouldn't swear to that, Your Honor, without looking more closely at it. It's also important, I think, to look at the argument that's now being made that this is a clerical error. It's just not a clerical error. If it was a simple clerical error and not a substantive change, we wouldn't be here. We're here because it affects a substantive right that my client had before and doesn't have now. And it's just a clear case of latches and waiver. The record does indicate, because my pretrial brief is in the record, you know, that Mr. Nist has a JD, and he had a lawyer. And he clearly found an error, and he didn't pursue it. He said, I'll have to amend the judgment if you're not willing to agree to these things. I didn't agree to those things. All he had to do was walk down and file a motion in front of Judge Grosshands or ask for a hearing in front of him to clarify it if that's what he wanted to do.
But it does seem a bit paradoxical that the judge would say, you get your pension, Mrs. Nist, and you get your pension, Mr. Nist, and then he's impliedly saying that she's also going to get a part of his pension when he doesn't say anything to that effect.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, if it said those words. But what it says is the cash value. And this record does not tell us what the cash value is. And that's one of the reasons for latches.
But doesn't the exhibit tell us what the cash value is?
It tells us how much it is. It doesn't tell us what it is. Is it present value? Is it contribution value? What is it?
Were there arguments made about any other value other than the 93 and the 54,000 figures?
Arguments made to whom, Your Honor?
To the court, to Judge Grosshands.
I don't remember, Your Honor. And in fact, my answer is the very reason that latches should apply. It's amazing that because I don't ever throw my files away, that I had a file that was 9.5 years old. You know, the reason we have statutes of limitations and the reason that we have time limits on motions is for the very reasons that exist here. You know, people die, people leave the bench. You know, we limit people who have a very definite cause of action, a malpractice action. And if they don't do it in 2 or 3 years, they're out of it. That doesn't mean they didn't have an action, but they didn't act on it timely. And that's the same issue here. You know, we're trying to recreate a case that's 9.5 years old. I mean, who would even expect that a property settlement would be changed 9.5 years later under the case law from this state, from this court? But yet that's what we're being asked to do at this point. So I think that question, Your Honor, begs the question as to why latches and waiver don't apply. Because it's clearly to my client's detriment that we're trying to recreate a record at this point. But the part of the record that we do have is that they recognize there was a problem. And we certainly put it into evidence, so we weren't hiding anything. Certainly wasn't my obligation to specifically waive it. All it had to do was be raised if that's what he wanted to have done at the time. And had he done that, it would have been addressed. What would be the outcome? I don't know. I don't know, because certainly I would have opposed it. And certainly if it had been raised, I would have said, Your Honor, then I ask you to reconsider the alimony in light of the fact that the alimony was 5 years instead of the 10 years that we had requested. So that's the problem with this case. I think if you look at it from a clear legal perspective of is this right and fair, it was easily solved. Ask the question of the decision maker. Don't try to say it's a clerical error 9.5 years later. Because at this point in time, trying to recreate that record is impossible.
So let me ask you this then. What if we're if we agree with you, what exactly would we do then? Would we reverse and remand with some directions, or what are you asking this court to do?
I'm asking the court to find that under the response that we made, which was a motion to dismiss, and in the alternative we filed affirmative defenses, that this matter should have been dismissed as a property settlement. It does not fall under 60B. It does not fall, it's unreasonable time under 60B, clearly. 9.5 years when you have knowledge has got to be unreasonable. And 60A, that it's not clerical. This court can find that it wasn't a clerical error and that under 60B it doesn't apply and reverse the decision.
If we don't agree with that, but we might agree with your Lanch's argument, would it have to be remanded for findings on that?
Well, obviously this court can't make findings, factual findings, so I suppose, yes, Your Honor, it would probably have to be.
In contract law, an ambiguity or something that's not clear is construed against the drafter of the contract. You drew the key form, I guess, in this deal. Does the same law apply that any ambiguity or anything equivocal is construed against the drafter?
Your Honor, that might be the case, except here's the same problem that we have, and that is that my recollection, and this is extra record, okay? My recollection is that Mr. Sweetland and I worked together on that exhibit. I cannot tell you any more than that's my recollection. But the other thing is the judgment that was proposed, I just took exactly the judge's words. I mean, he said cash value of, and I put cash value of. I mean, I just took his words because I prepared the judgment for him. But I don't remember, honestly, where those figures came from as I stand here today. And that's part of the problem. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your time has expired. Thank you. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.